Right. Thanks for coming back in time, and hopefully we will have a good discussion like we had for the rest of since morning. And this time, we're going to discuss on revenue, revenue recognition update. I understand Natasha is going to do the honors of explaining what's up there, and ably complimented by Glenn and Sarah.
Allison.
What the hell is
Close.
That?
Close. Good morning, everyone. Or sorry, afternoon.
It's been a long day.
This is a PSB meeting, not a FESB joint.
She's preparing for tomorrow.
Yeah.
After the publication of the revised exposure draft for revenue last November and the period of outreach and comment letters that we received, the redeliberations began in May. And that's what we'd mainly like to speak with you about today, is just an update on where we are in the project, specifically what the board's tentative decisions are so far, what we're discussing this month, and what is still to come. If we turn to the fifth slide, which is actually labeled slide 15 in your deck, that is going to be the basis for what I'm going to talk about. So you can see from this slide that we're right in the middle of the redeliberations. And a lot of those redeliberations so far have been refinements and clarifications that reflect the feedback we received, which was that people were broadly happy with the revised exposure draft. These refinements include identification of separate performance obligations and the satisfaction of performance obligations, which Allison and Glenn will touch on in a little bit. These topics that have already been redeliberated that are mostly refinements also include many of the contract issues, measures of progress, and the time value of money. The board's also decided to remove the onerous test, a test which people broadly disagreed with. You may recall that we spoke to you about this at the joint meeting with the CMAC in June, and Allison will touch on that a little bit more in a moment as well. The topics that are going to be discussed at next week's November board meeting are licenses, collectability, and the constraint. And all three of these topics have already been brought to the board in the past few months, but the board asked that the staff do further work on these issues before any decisions were made. And again, we'll elaborate on that in a little bit. The upcoming topics, which include the proposed disclosure and transition requirements and scope issues, will most likely spill over into 2013. And those proposed requirements were another area of disagreement, specifically between preparers and users. Because of the divergence in views in this area, in preparation for the topic to be discussed at the board table, there will be a workshop, or there are a few workshops that are being held here and in the U.S. And the aim of these workshops is to facilitate discussion between the users and the preparers, so that we can achieve a goal of balanced disclosures that are helpful to users and still reasonable for preparers to generate. Even though discussion of some of these topics will be in 2013, the boards still plan to publish the final revenue standard in the first half of 2013. Before Allison and Glenn jump into any detail, are there any questions?
Could you talk about the scope topic and what's going to be changed on the scope or considered to be changed?
So with scope, obviously the scope of the standard is based on the definition of a contract and the definition of a customer. And things that fail those criteria would be outside of scope. So either if you don't have a contract or you've got a contract with someone else other than a customer, then you're outside of scope. So one of the issues that we will look at a little bit further and we did receive feedback on was, what is a customer? Can you tell us a bit more about determining whether or not my arrangement with this other party is an arrangement that effectively is a supplier-customer relationship, or if it's some other type of relationship, such as perhaps a collaboration type of arrangement? And that's presumably where I think you're your comments coming from, Sandra. And I think there we will try to develop something a bit. I wouldn't say that we've... People have asked, particularly some in the extractive industries, I think also some in the pharmaceutical industry where there is collaboration as well, have asked for a little bit more clarity about, you know, how we can determine whether or not your arrangement with this other party is more in the nature of a partner-to-partner relationship or a partner-collaborator-type relationship or a supplier-customer relationship. We looked at this a bit in the last ED as well, but we did struggle to develop or think of how we could develop much more in a way of more specific guidance. That can help with that sort of distinction. But because that was another theme from feedback that we got on this 2011 ED, we will be looking at that once more to see if we can do something a bit more. Now, by a bit more, that might not be an expansive set of criteria, but we might be able to, you know, perhaps develop some indicators or something that can help with that assessment. Obviously, because that's an important assessment to make, it determines whether or not you're inside the scope of the model. Perhaps relevant to some others around the table, not every contract with the customer will be within the scope of the revenue proposals. So if you have a lease or insurance contract or something that contains a financial instrument, you'll account for those arrangements in accordance with those more specific standards. And there are some questions, I think, in particular with some of the financial instruments interactions, just better clarifying how the interaction of those two standards works. So that will be another component of what we consider. We're hopeful that at least, because there'll be a whole variation of sort of fairly discrete scope topics, we're hopeful that at least some of those scope topics will come to the board at their December meeting. Obviously, one of the things that we need to get to before we get to December is have a successful November meeting. So we'll sort of see how that goes.
So the intent is not to move the bar, but to...
Yeah, there is a lot of concern, especially in the collaborative area, whether we intend to change the guidance to bring them into revenue standard.
Right.
And to my understanding, there is no intention of that. It is anything... the idea is to clarify those things a little bit more clearly. I know pharmaceutical industry, for example, is extremely concerned about the collaborative arrangements and some other industries too.
I think some of it could have come from a comment that was made at the CCR meeting where somebody had said that the SEC was unhappy with some of the scope outs. And so all of a sudden we're concerned that that bar is moving, and it's good to hear that that's not the case.
That's, obviously, that will be for the boards to decide when we present it back to them, but that's right. Certainly been how we've been looking at it as the staff.
Would it be fair to say that there is a presumption that the revenue will capture everything except when there is a specific other standard dealing with the transaction, or will we leave some transactions undefined, not being revenue and not being elsewhere? I don't think that is the boss intention at all.
Well, I think it depends a little as to what might be causing the transaction to fall outside of scope. So we've been talking when we spoke to the boards in September on collectability. We noted that in some cases that the collectability may be so unsure that effectively it raises into doubt whether or not there's truly a contract between the parties, because it might suggest there's not enforceable rights. Now, in that discussion, I think a few board members said, notwithstanding that you may not have a contract that meets the criteria in the standard, and therefore it would technically be outside of scope, we should still provide some degree of clarity about how an entity would account for any sort of cash flows that do emerge in those arrangements. So that's one thing which we will look at, I think. I think the other type of arrangement, as Sandy was mentioning, is more to do with where the arrangement between the parties are not really in a customer-supplier relationship, but they're more partners or collaborators. And that takes us to a completely other end of the spectrum, and I don't think we can expect the revenue standard will necessarily appropriately deal with those arrangements.
it will be something. Kevin?
This isn't coming from the mining industry. On transition guidance, is there going to be, or is there consideration that where an entity currently might have its standard contract, cause it to end up with a different type of accounting than it currently has, but now goes through this transition period to realign and change its standard contract, that would be considered as part of transition rather than end up with this wobbly history, i.e. they might have a contract that says it wouldn't qualify for revenue yet under the new rules for this comparative period. But by the time the statement comes into play, their standard contract, which they've amended, would now qualify. You're going to end up, if we don't find a way to balance the fact that management's changed its standard contracts, you're going to end up with wobbly precedent in your history.
And I think that's something which I think Bob may have mentioned in previous meetings as well, that in some industries, how contracts are written is very dependent on the revenue recognition practice. So if we change the revenue recognition practice, that in a sense, doing retrospective application may not always provide useful information because that doesn't really reflect the economics of those contracts. So that will be a factor, I think, for the board's decision when we come to look at transition again. And one of the things, as Natasha mentioned, we are holding these disclosure and transition workshops with some preparers and users towards the end of the year to better understand. Effectively, I think you could say at the outset, preparer and user views are quite polarised on matters of disclosure and transition. One of the things we're trying to do with these workshops is to understand exactly, well, are they really polarised views in all cases, or can we identify that actually users don't always want, whilst they might have a general preference for retrospective application, there'll be certain circumstances where they don't really need a lot of retrospective application. And similarly, there might be some disclosures which perhaps they don't really need, but as a general preference, they are more interested in more information rather than less. So that sort of feedback as well about how contracts are written to reflect the revenue, that will be one of the questions we'll be asking users as to how they would perceive transition should be applied in those cases.
I was carrying that question. That's not a mining question.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess what Natasha has sort of just provide you an overview of was a bit of our sort of redeliberations plan and sort of our measure of progress, if you will, in our redeliberations so far. And I think if you look at the slide following, slide 15 or 5, it's slide 6, and that's got the sort of the overview of our sort of proposals and the steps to apply the model. And I think just perhaps to couch what Natasha said in a similar way, we've redeliberated some areas of step one about identifying the contract. Two other areas that we have redeliberated, which are fairly central to the application of the model, are step two on identifying the separate performance obligations and step five on determining when a performance obligation is satisfied, and in particular, when a performance obligation is satisfied over time. So I might just spend a couple of minutes just to explain or give you a bit of an overview of the decisions the board made there, because obviously they are very central to the application of the revenue model. And so if we turn a few pages forward, slide number 9 sort of outlines the board's decision. So this was a decision the board's made in July at the start of our sort of re-deliberations about step two. And step two is all about identifying the separate performance obligations in the contract. We do that so that we can allocate transaction price to them, and we recognise revenue at that allocated amount as or when those performance obligations are satisfied. So in effect, the performance obligation is a separate component of the contract. We identify those performance obligations on the basis of whether or not a good or service is distinct. And we got some feedback from the 2011 ED where people were saying they sort of agreed with the philosophy that we'd outlined and proposed in the ED, but they found it a little bit hard to understand are some of our distinct criteria that we had proposed in paragraph 28 and 29 of the ED, and that's sort of summarised on the left-hand side of the table at slide 8. So what we've tried to do is to keep, as Natasha mentioned before, this isn't really a change in decision. This is about refining and clarifying what really the board's intended to, and hopefully the revised decision will be clearer and easier to understand. And essentially what we're now saying is, which is largely what we said last time as well, is you'll have a separate performance obligation if the promised good or service is distinct. And a distinct good or service has to have two attributes. First, the distinct good or service has to be capable of being distinct. So that must mean that the customer can benefit from that good or service on its own or in conjunction with other readily available resources. And in effect, that sort of sets a floor. So you can't break down a contract to an account separately for anything that's not capable of being distinct. But in some industries, construction is a good example, each brick, tile, piece of timber, each labour hour is capable of being distinct on its own. But obviously we don't want to break down a construction contract to build a house into multiple separate performance obligations. And so that's why we have this sort of second condition. And that is that the good or service also has to be distinct in the context of the contract. And when you think about a construction contract, really the promise isn't to supply a whole bunch of bricks and timber and labour hours to the customer. What the entity's promise to provide the customer is the construction of a house. And so in that case, we've clarified that criteria to say, well, you need to assess whether those goods or services promised in the contract, are they effectively the output of the contract, or are they merely inputs used to produce the output for the customer? And that's what we're trying to get to with this distinct in the context of the contract. One other piece of feedback, and we previously had that at sort of paragraph 29 of the ED, and we'd set some criteria sitting underneath it. And we got some feedback that suggested that sometimes that criteria might be too definitive in some cases, and it might inappropriately lead to too much bundling up of the contract or of the performance obligations in the contract. And so it was suggested that perhaps an indicators would be a better approach to deal with how you break down the contract into separate performance obligations, but specify a clear floor to say that you can't break a contract down below a certain point. And that's really what this capable of being distinct criteria is, as I mentioned before. It's intended to be a floor.
Okay, Glenn, can I just ask a question at this point? Previous slide, page 8, you've got the term viewed as an accounting policy choice, and that was presumably feedback to the ED in November.
That's right.
Let me ask you a very specific question, because this is the one that's been bothering me. Is if I look at telecommunications business, and I'm sure this is the one that you've got, one of the ones you've got at the back of your mind, where we've had discussions in the past that O2 may give you a free handset, and you then have to take a 12-month contract to take their phone service. Is that now likely to be regarded as one service rather than distinct, or is it going to be an accounting policy choice? So is a telecommunications business going to be pushed down the route of breaking them apart, or is it going to be likely to be bundled, or will they have a choice?
They won't have a choice.
Right.
And under our criteria, our distinct criteria, they will have to account for two items. They'll account for the handset as a distinct good, because it is capable of being used on its own or in conjunction with other things that are readily available, i.e. the network service. And they'll account for the network service as a separate distinct service. Now, in the 2011 ED, effectively what we're saying is each increment of service could be capable of being distinct. Mm-hmm. So almost each minute of airtime could be capable of being distinct. And so what we were concerned with, as some people had interpreted the ED, is with any sort of repetitive service contract, so people might be able to argue that they don't have one performance obligation to provide 12 months of network service contract or cleaning services or whatever. Rather, they have got 2 6-month performance obligations to provide, or 12 1-month performance obligations or whatever. And that was the concern, that that was where the accounting policy choice was. Why did that matter? It mattered in part for how we defined whether or not you had to apply the onerous test.
No, I understand. The question wasn't so much about the time period of the ongoing service. It was whether the handset is a cost of sale or a sale itself.
Yeah, it's a sale itself. We are bringing back the telecommunications issue, but as a separate topic as part of allocation. Because the second question is, okay, after I said that you've got a handset as a distinct good and one performance obligation, you've got the network service as a distinct service and another performance obligation, how do we allocate the contract consideration between those two performance obligations? And that's where the industry has sort of remarked consistently over some period of time about their questioning of the cost-benefit issues associated with doing that accounting.
I think there's both a cost benefit, and I've detected whether it actually reflects the business model as they understand it.
Yeah.
That's fine. You know what? When I read this, I had the answer the other way around.
Okay.
I just showed that I should read the slides more carefully. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments on step two? So another sort of area where we have re-deliberated, which is very core to the model, is identifying if you've got a performance obligation satisfied over time. We've got a whole series of slides dedicated to this topic, from slide 14 through to slide 17. And the main thing to note, and probably it's the decision on 17 is where I'll focus, but we have this concept of you have performance obligations satisfied over time. If you fail those criteria, then you've got performance obligations satisfied at a point in time, and you need to determine, well, at what point in time is that performance obligation satisfied? And that's obviously very important, because that determines when you can recognise revenue. Now, most of the feedback we've received has actually been on the criteria for determining whether a performance obligation is satisfied over time. Again, just like with step two, our focus was not on fundamentally changing what was proposed. Most people were in support of what we proposed, but found some of the language and the drafting confusing and requested some clarification. So slide 17 is probably our best attempts at providing that clarification. And effectively, very similar to what we've proposed in the ED, but we've just rearranged the furniture a little. And essentially, a performance obligation will be satisfied over time if you meet one of these three criteria. And I'll just briefly explain them. The first one is that the customer receives and consumes the benefits of the entity's performance as the entity performs. So that's the criteria that should apply for most just service contracts, where it's quite clear that the customer is receiving the benefit from the service as the service is being provided. Now, sometimes it's not going to be clear, actually, whether the customer does receive the benefit, because benefit is actually a fairly subjective notion. So we will also clarify in sort of applying that criterion that an objective basis for assessing benefit is to consider a hypothetical assessment of, would another entity need to substantially re-perform that work that the entity's completed to date, if that other entity were to take over the performance obligation? If they didn't need to re-perform this other entity, that would mean, in effect, that the customer has received a benefit. And the classic case is sort of like a freight contract, something of that nature, where the customer may not perceive any benefit until the goods arrive at their doorstep, but effectively, as those goods are moving from point A to point B, if some other entity were to hypothetically take over that obligation, they wouldn't have to move the goods from point A again to point B. They'd have to move it from wherever it currently is to all the way to point B. And this substantially re-perform did create a lot of confusion as to how and when it was intended to operate. So I think this clarifies the application of that. The second test is the more the general test, which we had, which sort of existed from the 2010 AD as well, which is a performance obligation is satisfied over time if the entity's performance creates or enhances an asset that the customer controls as the asset's created. That will be quite obvious if it's clear that the customer does own the asset as it's being created, for instance, a construction contract on the customer's own land. Unfortunately, not a lot of contracts are that simple. And so we've got many cases where there might be sort of specialized manufacturing or construction arrangements, where the construction happens not on the customer's site, but on the manufacturer's site, and or in various parts of the world, how we account for residential real estate apartments. And so the criterion that's designed to apply to those, and from which we've generally received quite good feedback that this criteria works, is to identify whether or not the assets, the entity's performance creates an asset with an alternative use to the entity, and if the entity's right to payment has a right to payment for work completed to date. If it meets those criterion, i.e. that entity's performance does not create an alternative asset with an alternative use to that entity, and the entity has a right to payment for work completed to date, that means that, in effect, the customer must control that asset as it's been created. Well, it's sort of a way to operationalize this concept of control. And so this was a decision which the board's made in July. We have been talking to some of those in industries to which this would apply. And I think, obviously, people always have more questions, but this seems to be providing a lot more clarity as to how they would account for their contracts. I'll just stop there. Any comments, observations on this decision or any of the other decisions about step five?
Just a question here. Yeah. Would that mean, especially reading C, that one of the next available software is a performance obligation that's satisfied over time?
Yes. We would think probably, especially that those if it has a sort of a stand ready type application, yes, we would certainly say.
Come again, the question is that if you have when and if available software.
If it's a performance obligation satisfied over time.
You mean just that portion of the portion that is the when and if available performance? Yes.
Can I? So, ladies, I'll perhaps go back to slide 15. I'm not sure if I was
paying attention.
Which
slide? The 15.
I'm not sure if I was paying attention. I've always had a problem with this the second bullet point from the end. Another entity would need to, and you put in brackets, other entity would not have benefit of any work in progress. So. Could it not be rephrased, the other entity would not need to have any benefit?
Yeah,
or anything?
Yeah. So that, this was our 2011 ED words. We've improved it.
Okay.
For that reason.
Perhaps wasn't paying attention.
Oh, sorry. I jumped over that just for the purpose of the discussion. But I mean...
Because it always gave me a problem.
Okay. And I don't know how to use.
The confusion that which you've just expressed was... almost universally held.
Ah, okay.
So that was a good reason why we rephrased the drafting of that. So perhaps if we go to the first occurrence of slide 15 on in the slide deck again, so it's slide 5. So that's a very short and very selective overview of the redeliberations to date. Coming up in a couple of weeks' time, as Natasha said, we're discussing the topics of the constraints on revenue recognition, where some people had asked effectively, there were some differing views about how the constraint should apply, and some constituents felt that the constraint that we had proposed for constraining the cumulative amount of revenue recognition was perhaps not strong enough. And wanted a clearer objective to determine whether or not revenue should be constrained. And really what we're talking about here is where the customer has promised variable consideration to the entity in exchange for goods or services. So that variable consideration needs to be estimated. And the constraint is all about whether or not that estimate of variable consideration is based on good quality predictive information. If it is, then an entity would not be constrained and could recognise as revenue those amounts of variable consideration that are allocated to a satisfied performance obligation. If those estimates of variable consideration were, this is shorthand obviously, but not based on good quality information, the entity would be constrained from recognising those amounts as revenue until that uncertainty had resolved. The collectability topic is another one, and as you've probably known, over time we've sort of, our proposals on dealing with collectability, customer and credit risk have evolved slightly, where in the 2011 ED we are proposing that revenue and transaction price that becomes allocated to performance obligations and subsequently recognised as revenue, that would not be adjusted for the effects of customer credit risk. But you would show the effect of customer credit risk in an impairment loss line that's presented adjacent to the revenue line. So if we think of a simple example, if there was a good or service was sold to a customer for $100 and there was a 5% chance that the customer wouldn't pay, the entity would recognise revenue when they've transferred the good or service to the customer of 100 and show directly adjacent to the revenue a $5 impairment loss. If there was a 20% chance that the entity assessed the customer wouldn't pay, you would show revenue of 100 and an impairment loss line of 20 adjacent. So the proposal would deal with effectively visibility and transparency of the impairment loss line adjacent to the revenue, so that the user of the financial statements has two pieces of information available to them. They can assess the entity's performance in making sales and the amount that they're entitled to receive from the customer, and they can separately assess really the likelihood that the entity expects to collect that amount of revenue from the customer. Recognising revenue at the entitled amount received a lot of support from respondents. The co-location of the impairment loss line adjacent to revenue received less support from respondents. Preparers generally would prefer it to be, they consider it an expense item and would prefer it to be presented down below with expenses. Some users were also supportive of that presentation approach, but provided it was presented prominently. They want to be able to see the impairment loss line and the revenue line. It doesn't necessarily need to be adjacent. Some were concerned about the implications that might have on gross margin. So would gross margin therefore be less the impairment loss line, whereas today it's not. But some other users and some regulators are perhaps more conservative and would want to see effectively either a revenue recognition collectability threshold be reintroduced in the revenue proposals, or if we're not doing that, to require the collectability line to be shown adjacent to revenue so that there is that clear relationship that the user can see between those two amounts. So we had a discussion on this in September, and it was inconclusive discussion in the sense that there were differing views around the board table, and the boards asked us to do a little bit more thinking before we bring it back to the boards. So that will be coming up this month. But largely the options we'll be presenting to the board are the 2011 ED approach with the adjacent presentation of the impairment loss line, an approach of presenting the impairment loss either generally down in other expenses, which has a lot of support in the preparer community, or the reintroduction of a collectability threshold, and we've sort of outlined the pros and cons of that. So I won't say any more on that other than watch this space.
The only thing I would add to that is the problem I have with the adjustment effectively to the revenue to get from a gross revenue to a net revenue, this collectability line, is that the corollary is that you can recognise net revenue without selling anything. Because if you recognise 100 this period and you have a 10% collectability provision that takes you down to 90 revenue. If you then collect it in the next period and you don't do any activity in the next period, which could be possible in certain things, you would have 10 of revenue in that next period without selling anything.
So you can do that anyway because there is changes in estimates and other parts of revenue recognition.
Not quite so much, not quite so defined like that. But yeah, I do take your point a little bit, particularly in the pharma industry on discounts, but no, I'm thinking more on a construction. That's my problem with it.
Anyway, Glenn, if I may, I mean, since we are preparers here, I mean, I'm sure if we did a straw poll amongst the table...
We don't need that.
You know what we tell you to do. Just it's from excluding perhaps the financial services industry. For most of us, this is an immaterial amount that you're asking us to disclose. And I personally would say you should allow us, since it tends to, if it is immaterial rather than be prescriptive, you should allow us to put it in footnotes where it would belong as an extra disclosure.
So when you show us a footnote, let's suppose 100 is the sale, and let's say immaterial amount, €1 is the collectability issue. So would you show 99 as a revenue in the statement and show $101 or €1 in the footnotes? How do you, can
no,
you
I'd
explain?
I'd show it gross.
You show 100?
100.
Number one in the expenses.
And one somewhere in the marketing expense or whatever, which is...
The disclosure is one is included in 20, which is my marketing cost, of which one is bad debt expense.
Yeah.
Malcolm, can I ask, if instead of it being one, it was, let's say, 40, and we've been given examples of certain industries where that might occur, or it does occur, timeshare sales was one that the board discussed many times. So I accept that in 99.9% of cases, it's just not material, and I would agree, put it down with expenses. But what about the situations when it really is material? So if it was 40, would you show revenue of 100 or 60?
I mean, you know, you're picking an industry which is okay. Not it's obviously not financial service industry, but it's sort of going a little bit in that sort of direction.
Come on, you know, you're going to say 60.
No, I think you. I mean, I don't know why you have to be so dogmatic. I think
if you look at it, there's two separate transactions we're talking about. One is a sales transaction, which you're recording at 100. Other is your estimate that how much you will recover from that. So if you have a normal policy that you put into other expense or marketing expense, wherever, you make a provision for 40 in that case and give a disclosure. If it is material, give a disclosure separately.
The FASB board members were very uncomfortable showing revenue of 100 in that case when you know full well that you're just not going to get 100. And that's been sort of the history of this and why we've sort of struggled with it. Because booking 100 just sort of misrepresents really the activity within that company and what they're selling.
What do timeshare industries do at the moment?
Well, they sell something. They don't do really...
No, I don't understand what timeshare... What do they do in their accounts? Do
their accounts, 100? They show the net of the net revenue.
They currently
60.
Show net. They currently show net.
It's a collectability threshold.
So here's the point I'm leading to. The current standards allow Malcolm to put 100 in his accounts and timeshares to put 60 in their accounts. So the concern I have with your example, Stephen, which is a very important one, is that we have one small part of overall industry wagging the dog. This one tall tail is wagging the dog, and that's what I don't like. You know I've had problems with financial service industries effectively impacting other industries because standards have been set with them in mind, and this looks like another example.
And if I may, to, you know, you give me a bit of time to collect my thoughts. I mean, I think this demonstrates the whole issue of the expected loss versus the incurred loss. We do not sell to anybody
to lose
if we book it as revenue. Now, we have discounts, and we fully agree that discounts are off the top line, and we estimate them. But you know, your issue there of a timeshare, they're saying, well, it's you know, they seem to be having a business model where even on day one, what they're sending out as an invoice, they do not expect to be paid. We expect to be paid everything that we book as the top line. We do not have a model where there is the you know, so they seem to have they seem to have. So they almost seem to have a day one incurred loss, is what I'm thinking of trying to say. So we much prefer the incurred loss for recognizing the doubtful debt provision. And incurred loss, we need triggering events. And it sounds like in this particular industry, even on day one, they even are prepared to admit they have, you know, they have a sort of incurred loss on day one. That's not our model. We do not have on day one any incurred loss. We have full expectation on day one of getting back whatever we book as top line sales.
There are plenty of industries, though, and I'm thinking furniture industries and others who sell on credit that have a legitimate expectation on day one that somebody in their portfolio is not going to pay back. And those industries are competing in a credit market against other industries who are in a cash market. And the question then becomes, if you've got somebody selling for credit and somebody selling for cash, and the guy selling for credit is selling for more, his price is higher. Are those two sets of sales that you're looking at comparable?
But they expect that how much would be recovered. Against a particular sale, they cannot say that, I mean, against a sale to X, I'll recover this amount. It's an overall expectation that where they make a provision. So still that, I think the logic holds good. That your sales transaction and your provisioning for doubtful debts in this particular case are two separate transactions. If you have a known price adjustment or a quantity adjustment or a quality adjustment, yes, that's a credit note. And that can be adjusted against the gross sales.
Even when you are pricing for an expectation of some kind of loss. So you're selling it for a bit more because you know you might lose some on it.
In that, that's what I said. I mean, it's a question of credit note. Then probably you'd adjust against the top line. But if it is an expectation against recovery, I mean, that, and based on a past experience, then I suppose it should go as a other expense or marketing expense.
Jayant, let me give you a scenario and see what you think about it. I sold you for 100 something, mm-hmm. for 100. You and I agree that you will pay only 90 to me. I will give it as a discount. Mm-hmm. What will happen?
I'll show 90.
90. Yeah. If I say that I sell you for 100 and you end up paying me 90, in essence, is the same thing. Why should the 10 should go into the doubtful debt?
Here it is. What example? What you said is a predetermined price that you were expecting that I will give you a credit note, and that is agreed upon by me.
It can happen later also.
It can happen later.
Any discount, the accounting says that net it against revenue, mm-hmm. right? Whether discount happened on day one or discount happens on day 20.
Yep.
Right. Now, in a provision for doubtful debts. Mm-hmm. Why is it not the same logic to apply?
It's not a discount. It's, when you talk about discount, it's discount on pricing. So actually your sales value itself is adjusting. If you're talking about provision against doubtful debts.
One was a unilateral decision. Yes. The other was not.
Absolutely.
I think they end up in the same place. Unilateral.
But would you agree, though, in your example, that one was a unilateral decision, the other was not a unilateral decision, in your example?
No, it's bilateral, too.
If
somebody doesn't want to pay it, I'll say, give you a discount.
The company agreed to sell something for $90 and receive $90. That's a unilateral transaction. In the other transaction, the company sold something for $100 but only received $90 due to the bad debt of the customer. That wasn't a unilateral decision on the company. They were still expecting $100.
You go back to your example of timeshare. I've not bought a timeshare, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. They have big legal costs. So I could well imagine that they fight hard for that $100, and only once they've gone to court and with a lot of legal fees do they settle for something.
No, that's the point. They don't fight for it because they don't lose. They just take the property back and then they sell it to somebody else. You know, in fact, it's good for them if people actually don't finish the full lot of payments because they make more money that way. It's an industry, and there are others as well, where the bad debts is not a problem. And and lots of medical examples as well, where it's sort of similar type of situation, and that's not the best example. Software is another one.
So it's
a completely different business model to yours, and I completely accept your position and the sort of the general approach to this, but we need to set a standard that is going to be applicable across every industry, and there are some industries where
a
different situation applies.
It's very interesting, and this is one of the sort of parts of this meeting I like. The corollary of what you're saying, if we go down the route of saying, here's your gross revenue, here's your collectability allowance deduction, and then here's your net revenue, is that depending on between industries, or depending on peers within an industry based on their business model, they will be asking comparisons to be made at the gross revenue or the net revenue line. So you're going to end up in divergence in practice, in that Malcolm will say, you should be looking at my top line, which is 100, whereas Stephen, Mr. Timeshare, is going to be saying, don't look at the 100, look at the 60. And that is the extension of what you're saying. Is that correct?
But I still feel there's a big timing issue. I mean, they don't know which customer is going to default on them, which one they're taking back. So, I think
the problem is not the location of it. That is partly of it. I think you're raising another issue though, Malcolm. That's not, you want an incurred loss model as against an expected loss model.
Indeed, I want the trigger point.
Yeah, so I think it's a two-pronged approach. But remember one thing, the existing literature, whether applied correctly or not, had this collectability notion in the top line, which was net. So yeah. All those people who are talking right now about $101, everybody had to show 99. Whether that's then in practice or not is an entirely different issue. So it's already there.
To some extent. I think the notion that you've now drifted down into credit risk, and then you start straying into areas where general industry, not specific, would regard this more as a bad debt type item. I think that's maybe where people are getting hung up. Again, the pharmaceuticals industry, discounts, because everybody takes the discounts, you're knocking off revenue. Fantastic. The pharmaceutical industry does not go and say, I'm going to assess the credit risk of my customers. In the end, the pharmaceutical industry knows that some customers will end up not paying for whatever reason. They, you know, a wholesaler may go bankrupt or something like that. But then that's a cost of business. And so you are inevitably taking generally accepted accounting principles, which has that down there, and you're forcing it up to there. So you're changing gap. That's where this discussion is coming from.
I wouldn't say it's just, I mean, I think it's... I would say it's the majority of most
businesses,
most industries. They believe that when they send out an invoice, that, you know, net of the discounts, that's what they're going to get paid. They don't have an expectation. There's no trigger event. It's inappropriate to make a provision until there is a trigger event.
But that's why I think those people who wanted a net presentation move their position to say, okay, show what is that you have sent as an invoice, as a top line, and the line after that, co-location, as Glenn carefully uses the word co-location, is to show what is your expectation that you won't collect it. It's to some extent a presentation issue. If you put a collectible threshold, it's not even a presentation issue. It is, yeah, you don't show the revenue
more,
anything.
More often than not, I mean, you as Malcolm is mentioning, we expect 100% recovery. As a prudent measure, based on your past experience, you make a provision. Not necessarily this to our lead. When you said you expect 100% money to be recovered.
Yeah, I want to know how much you actually collected, right, at the end of the day.
I mean, if you look at my particular company, I think it's very high. We hardly have any bad debt.
Then it should not be an issue for you.
Okay, but then you can't force us to put a peanut item. I mean,
there could be other models.
You cannot mandate us to put a peanut item underneath our billions of revenue.
Well,
yeah,
that's where materiality kicks in again.
Well, can we have a definition of materiality?
the prevailing feeling, the entire standard is there's materiality, and up to you to do.
Yeah, but PK, if the statement says it'll be co-located. every auditor will co-locate it.
Yeah.
If irregardless of material.
No.
Every auditor will co-locate it.
Absolutely.
Because the statement says it's co-located.
And the point is, the point about materiality is once you've calculated it, to demonstrate it's not material, it's material because you calculated it. So it's a material matter because you had to go and address it. I think my look, we've kind of
if material go put it here, but not.
We kind of hijacked it around collectability. I bet you weren't expecting that. But the issue I have goes absolutely back to more of a fundamental principle than standard setting, is that there's a subsection of industries wagging the main dog. And, you know, we have a situation at the moment which kind of works fine. Well, that's where my concern is.
I think in the interest of time, I know to some extent for me, sometimes I feel funny because this is a presentation issue. There are much more bigger issues in recognition and measurement, and sometimes we get sidetracked and talk about presentation issues more than the other. I think in that vein, I request Allison or Sarah to talk about licenses.
Yeah, and I'll try and do it in 2 minutes, which might be a challenge, but... the boards discussed licenses in July, and we didn't, again, similar to constraint and collectability, didn't come to any decision. You may recall that in the 2011 AD, a license is a promise to transfer a right that is satisfied at the point in time that right transfers, but the boards acknowledged that there's maybe other performance obligations or other promises in the contract that may or may not be bundled with that license, and obviously revenue would be recognized over time based upon whichever separate performance obligations that an entity identifies in that contract, whether it includes a bundle with a license or separate services. The crux of the issue in licenses is really that starting point, that a license represents a promise to transfer a right that's satisfied at a point in time. I think some board members felt that perhaps instead of it being a promise to transfer a right, that license is closer to a service, and perhaps it's really a promise to provide access to the entity's underlying IP. And the reason why that is important is that if the license is identified as a separate performance obligation without other services, the pattern of revenue would be different depending on whether you viewed that license as a promise to transfer a right or a promise to provide access. Thus, if it's a promise to provide a right, then it's satisfied at a point in time. Or if it's a promise to provide access, it would be a performance obligation satisfied over time, and revenue would be recognized over time. So we've brought a paper back that's going to be discussed by the boards next week that focuses on that promise. What is the promise in a license? It's a very difficult question. There's 3 views in the paper that sort of look at that promise on a continuum. So it's either a promise to provide a right, or it's a promise to provide access, or it's something in the middle with indicators of when licenses might be a right and might be access. So using Glenn's words, it's watch this space into where the boards might end up on that issue, but that's probably the quickest explanation of licenses I've given in the last few months. But that's where we are on that.
Those of us that sell software, we need to be worried there's going to be a big shift here, that currently we understand the sale of a software license would be up front. Should watch a space and expect a huge difference.
I think one of the views, the view that all licenses, I guess the third view is that all licenses represent a promise to provide access to the entity's underlying IP. But there is, it's not an exception, but sort of unless that license is really a perpetual license, in which case they see it as effectively a sale. So I think in a lot of the perpetual software licenses, they'd still be recognized upfront. But having said that, there's a lot large variation in software licenses, so there may be some other term licenses and other things that may be recognized over time under that view.
Okay, so you are looking at perpetual versus time-based. Okay.
That is part of the difference in that third view.
But if the staff's view, if the boards go with the staff's view, then there will not be any change to...
The staff recommendation is to go with the 2011 ED with some clarifications about how the model would apply to licenses. So it is that the promise in a license is to provide a right, and I'm not sure that would mean much change for many
staff. So it's the second one that would be... I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't...
No, that's okay. I was very quick.
So that's the first one, right? Not much change. The third one we just talked about. What's the second one?
The second one delineates licenses based upon sort of some of their characteristics. So some licenses are promised to provide a right. What we see there is probably a lot of software licenses because it's just an output of your intellectual property. And there's some indicators that we've got for that. Or a license to provide is a promise to provide access, which is a lot of brand type, trademark type licenses that we see falling into that category.
So can I be clear that what we have on slide 24 is what you're hoping that the board will behave themselves and go with that recommendation?
But then, Alison, sorry. I understood now what you were, but I was getting confused. Will you differentiate between a license and a subscription? Because they use the word license when they actually mean subscription.
Subscription is a term, I think, in US GAAP, if I remember correctly, that they use to get to revenue over time in cases where there may be other things promised in the contract.
Well, I'm sort of thinking that the audit firms sell you a license to access their databases, but it's actually a subscription because I can access it through the whole year and it's all varying information.
Yeah.
It's not a license per se.
And this is, I think this. I understand where you're going now. This is the problem with licenses is that there's usually other things with it. So the license is what you get, but it's also the service of access over time to this database. So actually those are two things that probably would be under the model bundled together to make one performance obligation that would be recognized over time.
Yeah.
I think that's the real difficulty with licenses is everything is, there's many things that are called a license, but there's so many other things that often go into these contracts. And sometimes you need to think about what those things are and whether they need to be looked at as a single performance obligation.
And what happens with the leases? I don't lease, I rent. It's the language, not the...
But Kevin, in your situation that you have a Big Four accounting firm access to it, would you really see that as a license or a service that you are getting for a period of time?
The contracts they keep sending me call them licenses, but they're actually subscriptions.
Yeah. The license,
service.
Yeah.
And license what happens is probably defining your rights.
Yeah.
And the restrictions of your rights.
What happens if...
It's the words.
If the license is paid as a royalty?
That's where I was coming to from my first question. Carol.
Yeah, and the royalty is part of the constraint that Glenn was talking about. In some ways, we have a specific paragraph in the 2011 ED, which is paragraph 85, that says when there's sort of license arrangements and sales-based royalties, you recognize that revenue as those sales occur. I think that piece of the constraint is not being re-deliberated this month because there was too many moving pieces with the other parts of the constraint and licenses, so it's coming back next month. But I think that paragraph might end up staying in the ED, but that we still need to do a bit more staff analysis on that, and obviously, you know, the boards would discuss that, I think, probably next month, depending on, as Glenn said earlier, how successful we are in this month.
That's a one long 2 minutes, but
sorry.
I appreciate your explanation, Alison. Any other questions before? I think you reiterated, Natasha, that you expect to get done by H1 next year. So, yes, Olivia.
Just a word about the effective mandatory dates. The standard because it there on page 25 is 1st January 2015 and a retrospective application requires longer time between issuance and effective date. I just want to say that prospective application as well. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, we cannot move any of our systems until we know what we will have to do.
Yeah.
So we are waiting for the standard to move systems, and then we have to make all the process, analyzing what the system should do, choose the system, test it, and then implement it. So it will take a long time.
I'll speak for myself, and this is not on behalf of the board or anything, purely on behalf of myself. If there is a, if we really get done in 2013 first half, I would personally expect the standard not to be effective till January 1, 2016.
It's very short. It's too short.
2 years also. 2.5 years.
16, you said?
Yeah.
If it's if the standard is issued in
first half of 2013, that will be
14, okay.
Yeah, 14, 15, 2.5 years, I would expect. 2015, you're right, might be a little too early. But I, that's purely my personal view. I'm not talking as purely as PK.
The problem is if you have to find the data from the year before or not. So if you have to find the data for the year before, you have to have implemented the system the year before. So I think that your timing is short.
Okay.
Can I just, one quick question. Glenn, this is really interesting. A lot of work invested in this. PK may want to answer this question instead. Is the resulting standard likely to be fundamentally different to the exposure draft? This is important, I think, because generally the principles, and they have been broken in the past, is that an exposure draft should set out the principles that are likely to be in the final standard. And the final standard shouldn't be fundamentally different from the exposure draft. Otherwise, you've exposed something which, or you end up issuing something you've not really considered. So is there a risk in this work that you're going to end up with a standard that is fundamentally different to the exposure draft? Well, maybe a takeaway.
Yeah.
If it is fundamentally different, we have an obligation to go for another exposure draft. I don't think we will shirk away from that responsibility, but the real question is that so far, nothing has been done to raise that level in my mind, but I can ask other board members to speak.
I think we're just tweaked.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly what it has been to date.
If you start standing outside and get the license as a UC that Alison was talking, maybe then we'll get there. Good. Thank you very much. Bob and Olivier, come on over. There's always a problem of being the last ones to present because the...
It's also you guys to understand the speaker.
Yeah, so you have 18 minutes to complete.
Oh boy. Take 17.
Go ahead, Olivier. Have you met this group anytime? You did present in the past, right?
Actually, I was willing to start with this. I think it's a long, long time that we haven't met. Probably the last time we met, or that there's an update on XPOL with the GPF was a joint meeting with the
CMAG.
Well, the previous name of the CMAG, the what?
Analyst Resource Group.
Thank you, the analyst. So anyway, so you should have received a couple of agenda papers, 6 and 6A. The purpose here is just to provide a brief update on what